And online as well,
Well,
trying
that'll
to
be,
keep the world on
yes,
Jamaica
well, that'll be vitally important, of course, with communications to people about where they can go if there are safe areas to actually go and shield themselves from the storm. How prepared is Jamaica for the sort of hurricane and storms that you're describing?
Yeah, well, we are prepared as we can be, and that's not to say that the preparation has been excellent. In terms of communication from the government, they have been good. Maximum commendations to them, 10 out of 10. They've held press briefings since last Tuesday. Every single morning into the early afternoon, the country has been updated.
Yes.
They've communicated clearly and timely. However, in terms of our infrastructure, our drainage cleaning consistency,
yes,
it's not good at
we're
all.
Going to we're going to have to leave you for the moment. Thank you very much, Giovanni Dennison. Good luck with everything in Kingston. That's it from me this afternoon. Welcome to both of you, Fee Glover and Rosie Wright in the studio. And thanks to the team on Times at One.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, in for Jane Garvey this week here on Times Radio.
In the next 2 hours, are we ever going to uncover the real story behind the China spies case? We'll talk to one of the MPs investigating it. Hurricane Melissa, as you've been hearing, has been branded the storm of the century. It is about to make landfall in Jamaica. We're going to talk to a British woman who lives there and hear just why the hurricane is so dangerous for her. We'll pay tribute to the brilliant Prunella Scales after her death, and our big guest is the actor and author Patterson Joseph of Peep Show fame, Vigil, much more on his latest book for kids.
But first, let's get the news now with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, good afternoon. Rachel Reeves is expected to have to find an extra £7 billion in her budget next month. It appears the Office for Budget Responsibility has downgraded its productivity forecast by 0.1%, resulting in the shortfall. The OBR will send the Chancellor the final draft of its economic forecast on Friday. Paul Johnson, the former director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, has told Times Radio that Reeves has a massive financial hole to fill.
If she really does need to raise significant taxes, and it looks like she might be in the 30 or 40 billion pound territory, and that's a pretty big increase in tax. That's 1.5% of national income. I think if she needs to do that, then it's really very hard to see how she does that without raising one of the big ones, income tax, national insurance, or VAT.
Labour has fallen to its lowest rating in a YouGov poll. The survey for The Times finds only 17% of voters would back the party were a general election held today. The Tories are also on 17, with the Greens just 1 point behind. Reform has a 10-point lead on 27%. Up to 10,000 small boat migrants are to be housed on military sites in a government drive to end the use of asylum hotels within a year. An initial 900 arrivals will be housed in two army barracks in Inverness and East Sussex from next month. There are plans to build prefab units similar to porter cabins. Isabel McKenzie is a Tory councillor in Inverness. She says the news has come as a shock.
This morning when I woke up with Times Radio to hear them mentioning Cameron Barracks, that was the first time I heard about it. And I immediately then got on to contacting the senior personnel at the council. And then, of course, it's been manic here, you know, the press getting in touch, because this is a huge topic and the social media is just going crazy in Inverness.
British tourists in Jamaica are being told to prepare for the island's strongest storm on record. The Foreign Office has set up a crisis centre to help those affected by Hurricane Melissa. Waves of up to 4 metres high could batter the coastline later this afternoon. A woman who's accused of stalking the family of Madeleine McCann claims she never intended to cause them distress. Prosecutors allege Julia Wandelt, who's Polish, plagued Madeleine's parents with calls, emails and even turned up at their home, claiming to have memories that proved she was their daughter. She denies the charges. Madeleine disappeared in Portugal in 2007. And the actress Prunella Scales has died at the age of 93. She was best known for playing hotel manager Sybil Fawlty, the bossy wife of John Cleese's Basil. Her sons Samuel and Joseph say she was watching Fawlty Towers the day before she died. The broadcaster Giles Brandreth was a friend of Prunella Scales. He's told Times Radio she analysed Sybil's character.
Why did Sybil marry Basil? Why does she stay? And she said, I had to work that out before it made any sense to me. And she said, I think I came to the conclusion that he was actually quite good looking. And maybe, she said, he must have been fabulous in bed because he was so impossible in every other respect.
And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Andy, thank you, and a very good afternoon. It's 4 minutes past two. Tuesday this week, you're in the company of Fee Glover, as always, and me, Rosie Wright. Jane will be back on Monday. And as you've heard, Prunella Scales, the Fawlty Towers actress, most famous for playing Sybil with her somewhat towering hairdo, raucous laugh, has died. Andrew Billen, the feature writer at The Times, interviewed her just last year. He's going to help us chart the laughs this afternoon, and we'll hear really how she was so much more than just a comedy actress. We're going to start today, though, by speaking to an MP on the committee trying to get to the bottom of why the China spying case never actually came to court. Also, the Chancellor is looking to wring out some cash from online casinos, slot machines and betting shops. We'll look at the consequences of taxing gambling. And as Hurricane Melissa is due to make landfall in Jamaica in the next couple of hours, I mean, the updates you've been hearing here on Times Radio have been, well, pretty stark. We're going to hear how the population are bracing for the world's strongest storm of the year. And also, as promised yesterday but delivered today, we're going to hear from an explorer who's made a career from finding and then learning from Indigenous communities all over the world, from Papua New Guinea, Peru, Brazil, Australia. But a charity are going to join us, and they say that now very click-hungry influencers are searching down these populations for views, and they risk eradicating the tribes who have clearly kept their lives private. We'll hear more. And our big guest after 3:30 is...
It is, Rosie, Patterson Joseph. Now, if you're a fan of Peep Show, then you'll know that the rather odious and just very disturbing, but described by one of our production members as very hot, Alan Johnson is played by Patterson Joseph. And you'd also know him from Vigil. And if you are a theatre goer, you'd definitely know him from his work on the stage. And he is also the author of a couple of books. He's already written a novel, and he is introducing us in time for Christmas, parents, take note, to his latest book, which is called 10 Children Who Changed the World. And they are superb stories about the kids from history who've got lost because, as he said, quite often the facts and figures surrounding their lives are really threadbare. So he's pieced together these incredible tales of the young girl who dressed as a boy in order to gain access to the naval ships and then went on to have a career as a seafarer. One of the first librarians in this country who was born to a family who you really wouldn't have expected to be able to enjoy education a couple of centuries ago. They're really brilliant stories, and we've already done the interview just in the interest of transparency, and it was just delightful actually to spend 20 minutes with Patterson. He's a very, very charismatic, engaging person. He does accents and voices, and I love a guest who joins in with the accents and voices. So that is to come your way at 3:30. Before we get cracking, let me tell you about the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. In at number three now, is this you? 150,000 homeowners under threat from Labour's mansion tax. And the mansion tax is in inverted commas there. It is rumoured that Labour is considering taxing owners of properties worth more than £2 million in next month's budget, and that would hit nearly a fifth of homeowners in Kensington and Chelsea. The second most read story is all about Hurricane Melissa. This is a live page on the paper, so you can get fully updated. It's the Category 5 storm, which is due to make landfall in Jamaica. It is the strongest storm on the planet this year. We're going to talk about that in a couple of moments' time too. And the most read piece on the Times website, and no surprise really, because she was such an addition to our cultural landscape for such a long time. It's an obituary of Prunella Scales, the actress who turned loathing into laughs. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You will need your digital subscription all together now, in harmony at the back. If you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
8 minutes past two. Now, the blame game over the China spy story is only growing. It centres on the collapsed prosecution of two men. This is Christopher Cash and Christopher Berry. They'd been accused, as you know, of spying for China. Well, both deny the charges, which were then withdrawn by the Crown Prosecution Services. Conservatives have accused the government of failing to supply key evidence for fear of upsetting China. How do we get to the bottom of this? Mike Martin is a Liberal Democrat MP and member of the National Security Strategy Committee, which is investigating the case, and joins us now. Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon, Rosie.
In essence, your suspicion leads where? What do you want to see investigated?
So, look, I think right at the outset, I should say this is really, really complicated and relies on trying to prosecute someone under a law that was written in 1911. So it was written for a completely different age. That being said, and, you know, we're halfway through our inquiry. We had witnesses yesterday and we have some witnesses tomorrow that we're seeing. My conclusion is that this is a good old fashioned British cock up. In order to prosecute this pair, what the prosecutors need to prove is that China was a national security threat to the United Kingdom. And in order to do that, the CPS, the prosecution service, asked the government to provide a witness. And they've got this guy who's the Deputy National Security Advisor. And he said right at the start, I can only give evidence that's in line with government policy. And the problem is that the government is not willing, and this is the current government and the previous government, there's no difference in their policies. Neither government is willing to say that China is a national security threat, even though there's loads of evidence that they spy on us, they steal intellectual property, they, you know, try and upset our elections. And so really, if there is any blame, and I think, like I said, I think this is a good old-fashioned cock-up, I think the CPS at the very beginning shouldn't have asked this particular civil servant to be a witness, because he could only ever give evidence that was in line with government policy. It would have been much better, in my view, if as their expert witness to prove that China was a national security threat, they asked a retired head of MI5 or the director of Chatham House, a think tank, because then they could establish quite clearly that China is a threat. And it wouldn't interfere with, you know, the government obviously doesn't want to be so explicit about it because they're also trying to trade with China.
So you don't think actually this was a symptom of someone applying pressure. It was actually a mistake or an error of judgment.
We really did look into that yesterday. Yesterday, we had the Director of Public Prosecutions, we had the Deputy National Security Advisor, we had, you know, a whole bunch in front of us. And we were very explicit in our questioning about whether there was undue pressure applied. Was it, did the National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, did politicians get involved? And that was, it was absolutely clear in our session yesterday that that has not occurred and that did not occur. And for the very simple reason that once the Deputy National Security Advisor had given his original evidence, which was way back in 2024, before the general election, he was told that you can't discuss your evidence with anyone because you are now a witness in a national security case. And if you do so, that will be contempt of court. So he was unable, for legal reasons, to discuss that with anyone. So it's definitely not that. It's definitely not undue pressure. And it's also not that it's the Labour government policy is not to you know, annoy China by calling the national security threat, because that was also the Conservative government policy. So all the Conservative MPs now who are claiming that this is the Labour government cocking it up, well, they had exactly the same policy. And the Deputy National Security Advisor, I asked him myself in the session yesterday, was very clear about that. There's no substantive difference between Labour and Conservative governments. So it's just a bit of a cock-up.
What is the consequence of the case not being heard?
Yeah, exactly. And we have a problem here, because whatever the government of the day is willing to say about China, The facts of the matter are that China is a huge threat to our national security, whether it's stealing commercial secrets, upsetting our elections, attacking our democratic institutions, economic theft, you know, intimidating Hong Kongers. China is a threat to our national security. And I think that the fact that we are unable, or have been in this instance, unable to prosecute a fairly open and shut case, if you look at the evidence, or we weren't even able to bring it to court, I think speaks volumes about perhaps some of our timidity in standing up to China. I think actually it's in China's interest to trade with us as much as it is in our interest to trade with them. And I think it's okay to say, actually, here you've spied on us and we're going to call you out and we're going to, you know, declare those spies persona non grata, or we're going to send these people to prison because you've recruited them to spy for us. I think we'd still continue trading with China. And I would like to see the government be a little bit more confident in calling out these problems and not being so timid in tiptoeing around China.
And there it's is worth one... stressing again. Oh, sorry, continue.
I was just going to say there is one good thing, which is that I said right at the start, this was prosecuted under the 1911, so before the First World War, Official Secrets Act, and that law has now been replaced in between this case starting and it collapsing. We've now issued a new law called the National Security Law Act, which is much better for prosecuting these types of cases. So if we'd brought this case under the new act, we wouldn't have had these sorts of problems with definitions of what a national security threat is and does it rely on the government's position and all the rest of it. And so we don't have those problems going forward. So that's a good thing.
So it should be a more streamlined process in future, yeah, if a case like this, yeah, was brought again. Yeah.
But they will. We regularly have instances like this. And the reason we brought that law in is so that we can prosecute them more effectively.
Well, we had the head of MI5 intervene at the time to say, look, just even in the last week when I'm making the statement, we have come across and tried to negate a threat, yeah, from China.
Yeah.
The word you used to describe the government and the previous government's approach to China was being timid. Mm. The big decision that is looming, of course, is this new proposed, it's been called the super embassy,
yeah,
that the Chinese would like to build right in the heart of the City of London. It's thought to be located over what would be very sensitive cables. Mm. That decision's been postponed and postponed again now until December. I think I can probably guess at what your answer would be, but I mean, how comfortable would you be then with the embassy getting the green light in that location?
No, I mean, I'm not comfortable with the embassy going there. I think the problem is, you know, we've got these two things and both of them are true at the same time. One is that we have a large trading relationship with China and we would like to continue and grow that. And the other is that China is a threat to our democratic institutions, our, you know, diaspora communities and, you know, our economic life. And they're both true. And I think what we need to do is understand that if we call out these things and say, I'm sorry, that embassy is not going to go there. We're going to offer you another site that's just as big and just as fantastic. But as you say, it happens to not sit on top of those data cables. I think we would not see a drop in our trade relationship with China. And I think there's some very instructive data on this, which is we went into the deep freeze with China, our relations did, when we met, the previous government met with the Dalai Lama, and the Chinese government said, right, no meetings, no agreements, nothing. But the trade continued, because trade is, as we know, trade benefits both parties. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. It's not a one-way street. And again, Australia and China have had these kind of spats where China's refused to buy Australian coal. And then they found that the power stations in some of their provinces couldn't generate the electricity to light the streets. So they just quietly started buying the coal again. I think we just need to defend our democracy where we need to defend our democracy. We need to stand tall and call out stuff when it happens and just be confident that actually that trading relationship is probably going to continue.
Mm. You're saying that there sort of is an almost uneasy balance that could be found. The final thing I just want to ask you about, Mike, while you're here, we've had new polling out today. And yeah. I just wonder your sense, or if there's any frustration really in what it shows us. This new poll out today puts, of all the parties, the the Liberal Democrats fifth after now the Green Party, and their membership has been surging really under its new leader, Zach Polanski, but also as the Labour Party has hemorrhaged quite a lot of support, yes, to the left, but also to reform. Why do you think it is that Zach Polanski is capturing the attention of voters in a way that the Liberal Democrats aren't?
Look, I mean, I think Zach Polanski and other people on the extremes, it's very easy to say stuff safe in the knowledge that you're probably not going to end up in government. And that's the position that Zach finds himself in. Here we are, 4 years out from a general election. There's no chance that the government is going to change before that point. We're going to have a Labour government until 2029 when they decide to call the next election. So in a sense, what polling is not asking, you know, who do you want to be the next government? It's an expression of kind of displeasure with the Labour government. And we see that as well in the reform surge. So I'm not too worried about that stuff. I think as well, if this is the YouGov poll that you're talking about.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, I saw that projected onto seats and what that actually showed. Because our vote, the Lib Dem vote, is much more concentrated, whereas the Green vote is spread across the whole country. And with the system that we have with first past the post, it actually showed that we were going to go up to 88 seats and we were going to become the official opposition. So if that poll does turn out to be true, I'm pretty happy with that, becoming the official opposition after the next election.
Would you ever have some kind of coalition with the Greens?
I mean, that's a crazy question. We're 4 years away from the election. Let's see what the election results are first before we start talking about who or what the possibilities are, what the maths is.
Mike Martin, the Liberal Democrat MP, thank you very much. More crazy questions to come, I'm sure, in the next hour and a half.
But also 4 years, Rosie. Fun times. Fun times. Right, crack on and do something, everybody. Coming up, we reflect on the extraordinary life of Prunella Scales, who's died at the age of 93. We're going to do that with superstar interviewer Andrew Billen. You're listening to Fee and Rosie on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar, and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone, and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programs and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Peace of mind comes with your new Wix Kitchen. Choose from a wide range of products reassuringly backed up with guarantees, and then relax, knowing you've purchased a kitchen that's built to last. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
And please don't worry, Jane and I don't come round and fit the kitchen ourselves. It's done by talented professionals. Let's talk now about the extraordinary life of Prunella Scales, who's died peacefully at home at the age of 93. Though many knew her best for her role as Sybil Fawlty, the sharp-tongued hotelier's wife with a towering hairdo and the unforgettable put-downs, much of her career was spent in serious drama, from Shakespeare to Pinter and Bennett. And then she came along to our TV screens with her husband Timothy West, detailing their travels on board their beloved canal boat.
I'm Timothy West, And this is my wife, Prunella Scales.
We're celebrating our golden wedding this year.
Yeah, 50 years. Feels more like 14.
I know.
We might be known as actors.
Basil?
But when we're not treading the boards, it's all hands on deck. Cast off, please.
Aye, aye, sir. We're canal nuts and we've been pottering around on them nearly all our married life.
But we're both getting on a bit now.
I'm going to need some help.
And since we're celebrating 50 years of wedded bliss...
Cheers. We're determined to make the most of what we love, whilst we still can.
Well, that is from Channel 4's Great Canal Journeys. Joining us to reflect on Prunella's life is Andrew Billen, feature writer for The Times, who interviewed Prunella last September. Andrew, very good afternoon. Tell us a little bit more about how you found Prunella Scales when you talked to her.
Well, I think now it was probably the last interview she ever gave. She was about to go on stage, not to do any acting really, but to take a bow for a contribution she'd made to a place she'd toured for years about Queen Victoria. And she'd recorded a voiceover of some of her diaries, and that was being used. And she was going to take a bow the next day or 2 days after I met her. She was, and there's no getting around it, and there was no secret, she had been suffering from dementia for a very long time, which made the interview quite difficult for that reason. And I think it would have been quite difficult anyway, because you talk about Sybil Fawlty. But she was quite imperious too. It was slightly frightening.
Yeah, so I have read that she had that kind of patrician air about her. And when I read that particular term, I thought, gosh, is that a euphemism for something a little bit stronger? I mean, patrician's an interesting word to use.
Particularly interesting to use of a woman,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah.
No, I knew there would be a problem talking about Fawlty Towers, because it's going to be the first line of the obituaries tomorrow morning or this afternoon, and she wouldn't have particularly liked that. And so we didn't talk for very long, maybe half an hour before she got too tired, and I was told to go more or less. But this was in her home where she died. And I tried to get a swivel of the conversation around to Fawlty Towers, and she says, "Oh, that's boring. Let's have a drink or move on or something." And I said something about, was playing comedy more difficult than playing drama? And she said, "Well, that's a silly question. It's all to do with character and how good the play is." So I wasn't getting very far on that. What she was very and touchingly forthcoming on was her marriage to Timothy West, who in fact was ill. I was meant to be seeing them both, and he'd had a fall, and I was told he was upstairs recovering. I think he was actually in hospital by then, and he only had a few weeks more to live. She didn't know that. And if there's any upside to dementia, it does save you some sorrow. So when I said, how is Timothy? She said, perfectly all right. Why shouldn't he be?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a tiny silver lining, isn't it, in what can be such a dark cloud. But it's really worth talking about their marriage, isn't it, Andrew? Because not every celebrity marriage, and they were both celebrities, lasts the passage of time in the way that theirs did. Did you get the sense that there was simply kind of no competition between them about who was the kind of more prominent person? We're allowed to say that actors have egos because it's what drives them onto the stage. But what did you sense about their union?
Yes, I think there's no doubt about it that because of Fawlty Towers, but also a question of attribution, in which she played the late Queen, Nan and Bennett play, because of those two sort of iconic performances, terrible word, I know, but they were. They went further than their audience watching, and when at the time those programs went out, because of all that, she was the bigger star than Timothy West. But I think Timothy was such a nice man; he didn't care about that very much. And it was a partnership. After all, they spent a decade or something on that narrow boat. I just imagine how tense that sort of holiday is going to be. And I said, do you ever tell him off? And she said, of course I do. Don't you have arguments with your wife? And I admitted that I did. But it was clearly a marriage based on a great deal of mutual admiration. She said she was very careful to praise Timmy's performances and back him up and boost his ego. You know, ego all over that that woman and that marriage and that household when I visited. But you know, what did that ego produce? It produced some of the greatest performances, some of the greatest moments on television.
Sure. I mean, I can understand, I'm sure all of us can, why you don't want your entire career to only ever be focused on one thing. And Cybill Fawlty was obviously her one thing. But it's difficult, isn't it? Because actually, as such a well-loved character, there are so many questions that you want to ask her about why she gave her that voice, what the motivation was behind the, you know, the very kind of acid delivery. Could you just not go there at all with her?
Well, you know, I did, you know, like a dutiful interviewer, I planned to, and I did, and I was immediately shut down. And of course, she was 92 then, and not very well, and I didn't want to get into a row with her. But, you know, the great question you want to know about the marriage is, why did they stay together? And even more fundamentally, how did they get together in the first place? There was clearly a class divide in the marriage, which was one of the great things in Fawlty Towers that was explored. But she was in the mode of saying, you know, I read the script and delivered it.
And there's not much else that you can say. Andrew, that's such a delightful insight into the life of Prunella Scales. Thank you very much indeed. Apologies to our listeners because we have a little bit of a dodgy line there, but it was definitely worth keeping with it. Kate says, I met Prunella once in a theatre bar. She asked if we were using a stool and could she borrow it. She was lovely. I was completely starstruck. Timothy West was there too at the bar, looking a little grumpy. If you've had a brush-in with either Timothy West or Prunella Scales and you'd like to tell us about it, as long as it's kind of nice, we'll read it out. 0333 003 2353. And I know that you're not a Fawlty Towers aficionado.
I'm not, no.
So we cannot go there with detailed examination of every single episode. But it's interesting that even though you haven't watched it all, you say that you absolutely know what it is that people are referring to when they reference it. And that is the sign of an iconic thing, isn't it?
It is. It looms so large in our sort of cultural heritage that, I mean, I've actually don't think ever watched an episode in full, of which I now hear today there's only 12 of them. And that is a real surprise because of the sort of iconic status it has. It feels like to me something that would have been as sort of prolific as Frasier in my mind. But you understand the cultural references when people mention, well, her and Fawlty Towers, because it's sort of really left its stamp on our culture.
Into it, completely seeped into it. I've got a friend who named her dog Basil, right. And I just couldn't understand the logic of that, because you would just then, you know, walk around a park screaming Basil, and you would only be able to do it in the voice of Prunella Scales, which in fact she didn't wish to do. Mm. But it is that level of cultural referencing. Right, that takes us to 2:30.
Coming up, could increased taxes on gambling be the answer for the Chancellor's, as you've been hearing today, ever-growing budget problems? First, though, let's get the news with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Rosie. Good afternoon. Rachel Reeves is expected to have to find an extra £7 billion in her budget next month. It appears the Office for Budget Responsibility has downgraded its productivity forecasts by 0.1%, resulting in the shortfall. The OBR will send the Chancellor its final economic forecast on Friday. Paul Johnson, the former director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, has told Times Radio that Reeves and other ministers have made a series of errors.
They told us before the last election that they wouldn't need to increase taxes or cut spending. Well, we knew at the time that wasn't true, and so they did increase spending, and they massively increased taxes last year. And then she left herself with no room for manoeuvre against her, quote, ironclad, unquote, fiscal rules in that budget. And then she made the mistake of saying, and I won't have to come back for more. Well, I'm afraid it looks like she is going to have to come back for more.
Up to 10,000 small boat migrants are to be housed on military sites in a government drive to end the use of asylum hotels within a year. An initial 900 arrivals will be housed in two army barracks in Inverness and East Sussex from next month. There are plans to build prefab units similar to porter cabins. And British tourists in Jamaica are preparing to face what could be the island's strongest storm on record. Hurricane Melissa will hit the Caribbean island as a Category 5 storm, the top category. The Foreign Office has set up a crisis centre ready to help Britons who are there. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Mr. Thing loves winter. Fluffy slippers, hot chalk, the heating on. Uh-oh, that didn't sound good. Looks like the boiler's packed in. Thankfully, Mr. Thing has British Gas Home Care cover, which means unlimited repairs for his boiler, heating, electrics and more. So he's covered for whatever winter throws at him. And right now, it's 50% off for the first 6 months. Search British Gas Home Care, one of the ways we're taking care of things. T's and C's apply. No claims within the first 14 days. Ends 1st of December. New customers only. Remaining 6 months at full price.
Nobody asks to have a lifetime of memories slowly erased. Nobody asks to have a loved one not recognise them. Nobody asks to feel lonely and confused. But today, you could change this. By leaving a gift in your will to Alzheimer's Society, you'll help fund life-changing support, vital campaigning, and groundbreaking research to tackle Britain's biggest killer. Discover the impact your gift can make. Search Alzheimer's Society Wills.
No one sees your small business like you do. The feeling when that unexpected big contract comes in. The butterflies. But that's the exciting bit of it being your business. And you wouldn't have it any other way. So breathe it all in. When your business is your life, we exist to help you live. Search O2 Business.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. There's over 70 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the Spend and Save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
I've just had a huge dose of nostalgia with a message that's come in from Vicky saying Prunella Scales also did a brilliant range of accents, as we've been talking about, and brought all the characters to life in the children's book Pong Whiffy, A Witch with Very Smelly Habits. I loved reading that, which is how my children knew her. We still quote lines from this story, even with her character accents, which were timeless, superb and hilarious. Well, we will enjoy this afternoon, I'm sure, charting more of her career and the laughs that she engineered, whether that was on audiobook or, of course, on Fawlty Towers. Coming up after we're off the airwaves, John Pienaar takes over with Times Radio Drive. John, good afternoon.
Hi, Rosie.
Tell us what's coming up.
Just listening to that, it is strange how you kind of freeze your memory of a character like Prunella Scales, especially in Fawlty Towers, at the last moment you saw them on your telly. When I heard that she was dead at 90, I thought, is she 90?
90? 93,
she
John. Yeah.
She looked very young on Fawlty Towers, which was, I don't know, so long ago. Anyway, I'm going to be talking about the Hurricane Melissa. Talking to a couple of journalists on Jamaica in different parts as the hurricane makes landfall and starts to move across the island. What's it like being there in that, watching that going on out of the window, but also waiting for it to hit? The waiting must be as difficult as actually living the thing as it goes through. I'm talking about medical misogyny. The health secretary says there's going to be action on that. I've always thought that's a curious phenomenon. Women are half the population. I don't understand why it is still a matter of debate and people saying there's going to be action. It always slightly baffles me. But I'm talking to Steve Brine of the Health Committee. I'm talking about the story about fly tipping going on without not many people doing very much about it. And my very fashion-conscious team have arranged a conversation about toe shoes, which I think I've seen pictures. They are particularly at the top of the shoe, the toe. They divide and leave room for your toes. I can't imagine why anyone would ever wish to put on such a thing.
But so is it like a hard-soled sock?
It's got individual toes.
Yeah,
yes.
In the shoe. So you can, particular toes go in a particular bit of the shoe and you can see it as it walks about.
Okay.
And sometimes in two, like a cloven hoof.
Are you going to model any, John?
The answer to that is no.
Oh, okay. I wish you would. Come on, we all need some hilarity.
You can't see me on radio anyway.
You could post
you,
it
you
on your
socials. I could tell you I'm doing it now. You have to believe me.
John, thank you. John P. Nye will be here from 4 o'clock, and it's worth saying, just after the news at 3 o'clock as well, we'll be speaking to a British family in Jamaica just about how really difficult the last few days have been, knowing that this storm is coming, bracing for it, preparing for it, stockpiling. And so we'll see. The hurricane due to make actual landfall at some point in the next 2 hours. So we'll keep you across that here.
The campaign to see John Pienaar in toe shoes starts here. Yeah, it's not going away, John. Sorry about that. Stuart says Prunella Scales played the lead in a play at the Greenwich Little Theatre in the 80s, which I went to see. At the end of the first act, she had to look out at the audience and shout out her husband's name, which was the same as mine. And I still remember its chilling effect on me 40 years later. Marvellous actress in anything she did. Keep all of those coming. It would be delightful to sprinkle your memories of Prunella Scales throughout the programme this afternoon. And Paul, who's listening to us in Spain, absolutely, we will pass on your very best wishes to Miss Jane Garvey. Rachel Reeves faces a larger hole in the public finances than thought, with new productivity downgrades taking it as high as £37 billion. Think tanks, including the Social Market Foundation, say increasing taxes on gambling might be one measure that could help fill the gap. The industry has hit back, saying it pays £4 billion in tax and that a higher levy would risk tens of thousands of jobs. So let's talk about this with Theo Bertram, who's director of the SMF, and he's been given evidence to MPs today about these proposals. Theo Bertram, a very good afternoon from us. What exactly are you calling for?
Hi, thanks very much for having me. Still trying to get John Pienaar's toe shoes out of my head.
Yeah, it's a different one, and I apologise. Let's all just basically, let's do an Etch-a-Sketch. Let's wipe that from our collective vision.
So what we're calling for is that we see that there has been a huge growth in a new form of gambling, which is the sort of thing that you do on your phone. It's casino-style online slots, and it's called remote gaming is the technical term for it. And there's been a huge growth in that since the pandemic, an 82% growth in the revenue, the gross gambling yield, the technical term, between 2016 and 2024. So huge growth in their profits in this area. And we also know that this is the most harmful and most addictive form of gambling. So our proposals are about raising the taxes on that particular form of gambling. And what we're also proposing is actually trying to give more protection and more funding to horse racing. So the idea of a flutter on the Grand National is actually give some protection to that form of gambling.
Why would raising taxes on online gambling better protect people who've got into trouble with online gambling?
Well, online, this particular form of online gambling is the most harmful. And at the moment, what you've got is an industry that is rampant in this area, that is making huge profits relative to its other areas. And so that's why we think raising tax in that area will act as a counterweight to the industry and try and tackle some of the harm that we see there, encourage them to do more to tackle that form of harm. At the moment, the Select Committee this morning, the industry refused to acknowledge not only that gambling caused any social harm, but also refused to accept that there was any difference between that sort of gambling on your phone or going and having a flutter on the Grand National, whereas all the evidence points to there is a significantly more addictive and more harmful form of gambling, and that's why it needs to be taxed higher.
And I think most people really struggle with this, don't they? Because if we are seeing advertisements for gambling which are actively asking us to take a break if we feel we're in trouble, to gamble responsibly, it does seem to be a little bit difficult to entirely believe the voice of the industry, which says that no social harm is being done. There seems to be messaging that acknowledges exactly that.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And that's why I couldn't quite believe it this morning when the industry steadfastly refused to acknowledge any form of harm. And, you know, given that we're seeing this growth, given that we know that, you know, compared to sort of bingo or national lottery, you're talking about you know, seven times higher in some cases of the incidence of harm, given that we see that. I mean, the only thing more harmful in the analysis and the research that's been done, the only thing more harmful than those online slots is when you're in the position where you're betting on anything. So that's sort of where you're saying the next person to walk through that door is a man, right? That you sort of, when you reach that point of gambling, that's considered the most harmful. And second to that is online slots. So clearly that's not the same as having a bet on the Grand National or playing on the National Lottery. And what the industry tries to do is to cloak one of those sort of things in the rather more soothing idea of the other. And what we're trying to say is these two things need to be separated out and we need to do more to stop the harmful one.
Isn't it a very valid point, though, being made by the gambling industry that actually this is an established industry with established customers and they will go wherever they need to go to find the product, to find the place to do the gambling? And there has been a recent report, which is funded by the industry, by the accountancy firm EY, I think people of my age know that as Ernst & Young, don't they? Which claims that your plan would actually cost 30,000 jobs and it would simply drive billions to the black market, a place where people are not being looked after at all.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the key thing you said there was that was industry funded, and I think we would pour quite a lot of scepticism on that report on the basis of its findings. But let's take this issue of, is there going to be a big drive to the black market? Because this is an important question. If we raise taxes, are we just pushing people to illegal sites? And I think the first thing to say there is the illegal industry is obviously much worse than the legal one, and we should do everything we can to clamp down on that. But if we really saw that every tax increase meant that more people are on the black market, then you would expect those countries in the world which have higher tax to also have a higher black market. But we don't see that correlation. It's not the case that countries with a higher tax have a higher black market. And that's because things like regulation, enforcement, how good you are at tackling those things are much more important than the level of tax. Mm. So we believe you can raise the tax without driving people to the black market.
Do you think that it is possible to shut down part of an industry? Do you think it is fair to do that? The claim that your plan would cost 30,000 jobs, are you disputing the number or the fact that there would be job losses?
Both. I think what we're talking about is online gambling. Now, if you just think about that for a minute, and I know the industry are trying to make this about betting shops. And if you think about online gambling, let's say that you want to have 1,000 more people have a bet at a race course. Well, then you're going to need a lot more infrastructure. Well, if you're going to have 1,000 more people make bets every hour, every day on your local high street, you're going to need to have more people employed. You're going to need to maybe open another shop. If you want to have 1,000 more people every hour, every minute on an app, it doesn't cost you anything. There's no more extra jobs and the profit is all there, which is why those industries have all moved to that. And so this fear-mongering around the scale of jobs that will be lost is really a distraction. And one of the things that they struggled with today was to explain that relationship between the things that we're saying actually do need to be protected, like horse racing, where we've suggested actually there should be less money going to Treasury to protect those sort of online bookies, horse racing on-course bookies. And instead, we're saying you need to tax more highly that online, that most harmful sort, where there's fewer jobs as well. And so that's why we don't think that the report yesterday was credible. And obviously, it's funded entirely by the betting industry itself. Mm.
Through reading about the evidence that you're giving and about the report that you've made, Theo, I have learned an awful lot more about the Office for Health Improvement and Disparities, the OHID. Now, I think most people listening will not have heard of that office, will not know that acronym. What is that doing and who is funding that and how big is that?
So it's a part of the government's own branch of statistics. And what they're trying to look at is measuring, it's a very difficult thing to measure, but what is the wider harm caused to society? So one of the things that we can measure through surveys and things like that is what's the cause of gambling harm to an individual? But trying to then sort of add that up and think about what's the cost to society in terms of the impact when someone loses control of their gambling, when they steal, they bankrupt their families' finances, You know, what might the implications for long term sort of their own circumstances, of the cost to the state in terms of welfare, in terms of crime, all of those things. That's what that department was trying to measure. And they gauged that that cost was really very high. And since they did that report, we've only seen the level of problem gambling increase. And so today, when you add all that up, you would say that the cost associated with the harm of gambling are now greater than the amount of tax we're getting from those gambling companies. And that's another reason why we would argue that they need to pay more, because of a higher cost to society.
And do you think that we will ever see those kind of taxes hypothecated to directly go back to help people who have not been able to gamble responsibly?
I think the industry, to be fair to it, is trying to do things to help problem gamblers. And I think we can obviously do more. And I think that's some of what the idea of the levy will go towards. And I do think we can do better on that as a country. But I also think that at the moment, what we've got is a sort of unchecked industry when it comes to the level of harm in this area. And that's why we think adding a higher tax will add something of add some pressure to that industry to really look and address that harm. And it was telling this morning that speaking in front of the Treasury Committee, the executive representing that industry refused to accept that gambling caused any harm, or that there was a difference between the different types of gambling in terms of the harm they caused, which to anyone listening just seem like obvious common sense.
Well, there do seem to be an astonishing number of people who can tell you their life story, and it would definitely suggest that gambling has been problematic for them. Theo, thank you for talking to us. Theo Bertram is director of the Social Market Foundation. Eddie says, I used to gamble a bit and I now work for a gambling charity helping people with addiction. The industry is poisonous with a capital P. If you gamble with a strategy, you get closed down. These companies want you to lose, and losing large sums makes you a whale in the eyes of these companies. They prey on people who clearly have a problem. And Simon says, fee, higher taxes, leading to less gambling. What's not to like? Well, I suppose that is the point that Theo Bertram was making there. We'd love your thoughts on that. Anything that we're talking about this afternoon, you can talk about John Pienaar's toes if you want to. 0333 003 2353. We're also taking your memories of Prunella Scales.
As John regrets coming on this programme to tell us what was coming up a little bit later, let me tell you what's coming up here. We're going to discuss the AI service that could diagnose suspected prostate cancer in just a day. It's 2:50. This is Today. Fee and Rosie on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borse on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Embark on an evening expedition, rounding up the latest news and previewing tomorrow's headlines. Plus, don't miss Hit the Road, your essential weekly travel guide to the best destinations across the UK and beyond. The Evening Edition, tonight from 7 on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Designed for every adventure. Search New Volkswagen California to find out more.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
You searched for happiness, but society has its own expectation. You knew your desires, but duty stood in the way. You followed your heart to see where love could lead. And all the while, you were completing the spreadsheets. There's more to imagine when you listen. Experience Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy's love affair like never before, with the timeless Pride and Prejudice on Audible. Subscription required. See audible.co.uk for terms.
For over 100 years, Save the Children has been working to keep children safe, healthy and learning in the UK and around the world. Its work wouldn't be possible without the help of those who support with a gift in their will. This is Anne from Caerphilly in Wales, who shares with us why she's decided to include a gift in her will to Save the Children.
I feel really passionate to support Save the Children. It's very important for children to understand that there is a life out there that they can take part in without fear. Save the Children is helping children in war, conflict or in poverty, and the legacy that I will leave will help it continue with that work in the future.
From birth to adulthood, Save the Children is there to provide the support children need to stay safe, healthy and learning. Find out more about leaving a gift in your will. Search Save the Children Gifts in Wills. Save the Children is a registered charity.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious.
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees. Conditions apply.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
And it's 8 minutes to three. Now, men who need prostate tests are the most are the ones who are overlooked and actually aren't getting the tests. This is the warning from oncologists. Dr. Rachel Ward is a GP and co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast and joins us now. Rachel, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We hear quite a lot of confusing headlines, I think, around prostate cancer. And we're going to get onto this new diagnosis strategy using AI a little bit later. But why is it then that the most at-risk population are not the ones who are getting the tests?
Yeah, so we find ourselves in a strange position at the moment because we don't have a formal screening programme for prostate cancer. GPs are advised in the current guidance that they shouldn't be proactively telling people to get a prostate blood test, a PSA. So what this latest data has shown is that the people that are getting these tests, and essentially it's 25% on average of men in their 50s and 60s, each year are requesting a test, are the ones that are either educated or more wealthy in demographic. And of course, these are not the ones necessarily that are at higher risk of getting prostate cancer. So we can see that looking at the people who are getting PSAs, people who are from more deprived demographics, and black men in particular, who are at higher risk, are not the ones requesting this blood test each year. So as Professor Nick Jones, who's an oncologist, as you said, at the Institute of Cancer Research, said, we are over-testing the wrong people here. And that's really worrying.
How do you remedy that? I mean, we've had some quite high-profile cases of prostate cancer. Let's say the cyclist Chris Hoy, who was urging people, you know, get a test. We've had the same said on Times Radio. How do you get that message delivered to the right people?
Yeah, so of course, health education is always important, and I think that will continue to be very key. One of the requests from many charities in, you know, there is a review currently going on of prostate cancer screening. And one of the requests is that if we are not going to develop a national screening program, is there statistical evidence to suggest that it would be better that in these higher risk groups, they are called for a PSA blood test? So I think we're going to see over the next few weeks whether that is something that develops. So then we are actively calling the most at-risk people in for tests. That's going to be really an area to watch, I think.
And then what seems very exciting is this trial being reported about in the Times today, that men who are then suspected of having prostate cancer will be able to get a diagnosis within a day. You might expect that you'd get a biopsy, it would be analysed, someone would get back to you maybe in a fortnight. What's this trial going to do?
So we've moved forward with prostate cancer testing. So it used to be that everyone would start with a blood test and then you would have to have a biopsy, which obviously has quite a lot of morbidity associated with it. And so that, again, was one of the reasons for not having a screening program. However, we are now using MRI scans of the prostate much more widely as a second test after the blood test. But the AI is coming in that in this trial, AI will be interpreting those MRI scans. And so people will very, very quickly be getting a result of that scan. I mean, this is obviously fantastic. And it's a really good example of using technology to hasten diagnosis of cancer, which is always positive. Not wishing to be putting too much of a downer on this, from my perspective, my question is, that's great if you get an MRI and you get your result very quickly, but what's happening before that? How long are people actually having to wait to get the MRI for a start? Because we know that we have a low number of scanners per head of the population compared to other countries. And how long is somebody waiting to get a GP appointment to get referred for this? So I think it's really good, but we have to bear in mind that there are other bottlenecks in the system which do delay cancer diagnosis still.
There is another bottleneck looming, isn't there? The junior
yes.
doctors who are going to go on strike between the 14th and the 19th of November. That starts in about 2.5 weeks. So if there's going to be any agreement to stop the strike action, it's got to happen pretty swiftly. What are your feelings, Rachel? We've been here before and again, and the Health Secretary is saying very publicly on that pay demand, he simply will not budge.
Yeah, and I think what is important for people to be aware of, many people won't know the ins and outs of, you know, doctors' training, but one of the main issues that resident doctors have that they are raising with this strike is that they were told by this government that they were going to sort out the issue of training jobs. Now, we are in a situation at the moment, if you qualify for medicine in the UK, you do a 2-year job after qualification, that's called your foundation years, 1 and 2, and most people are more or less guaranteed to get a job if they meet the standards. After that, you go into specialist training, and this is where there is a real issue. So around 50% of people who have trained, gone into huge debt and done 2 years of work in the UK are then not getting jobs into further training because the numbers are not there of posts. So to give you some examples, there is a 5-to-1 applicants for GP jobs, 14-to-1 applicants for A&E jobs, 8.5 for surgical jobs. And this obviously seems crazy when people can't get a GP appointment, wait for 12 hours to see someone in A&E. But this, again, is where a huge issue is. And so people are saying, you know, we've put years and years of training and then it's not being honoured with being able to continue to work in the UK.
Yeah.
And that is really concerning.
The Health Secretary has promised to sort of increase the number of specialty training places, help with things like exam fees, but that's all part of a negotiation package. Very quickly, Rachel, I just want to ask you,
yeah.
of course, we've got the budget coming up. We know the Chancellor is potentially looking at taxing partners, of which you would be one. What is your sense about the idea that the Chancellor could be coming for the family GP?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I think, you know, we have already been hit by the increase in NI. That's had a massive impact on our finances and what we can actually spend in the practice. And ultimately, we're pretty small businesses. The more cost that comes our way, the less we will be able to offer, the fewer staff we'll be able to employ. So it is concerning, and it's not going to have a really positive outcome on GP services.
I can imagine. Rachel Ward, GP, co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast. Thank you very much for giving us a whistle-stop tour through all the health stories making the headlines today.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
All of that takes us to 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio. In the next hour of our programme, we'll get the latest on the strongest storm on the planet this year as Hurricane Melissa approaches Jamaica. The rise of influencers trying to make contact with isolated tribes is posing increasing danger to these groups. We will talk to a modern-day explorer. And today's big interview, we're going to hear from the actor and writer Patterson Joseph about his new book, 10 Children Who Changed the World. First, it's the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. Rachel Reeves faces an even bigger hole in the public finances than expected. The Office for Budget Responsibility has dropped its forecast by 0.1%, adding a further £7 to £9 billion in government borrowing. The OBR will send the Chancellor its final economic forecast before next month's budget on Friday. Oliver Wright, the Times' policy editor, says she has some very tough choices to make.
Reeves was very clear into the run-up to the election. She wasn't going to increase income tax. She wasn't going to increase national insurance or VAT. And it looks increasingly likely that she's going to have to do one of those things. And I think the verdict of voters after the budget, if indeed she does raise one of those taxes, isn't going to be great.
Hurricane Melissa is continuing to strengthen as it approaches Jamaica and now has sustained wind speeds of 185 miles an hour at its centre, according to the National Hurricane Centre. That may see the second strongest storm in terms of wind speed in Atlantic history, trailing only Hurricane Allen, which hit 190 miles an hour in 1980. A third of people in Jamaica are already without power. Giovanni Dennis, a journalist on the island, has told Times Radio what the feeling is there.
Anxiety. A lot of people are anxious. Even the authorities themselves are anxious. One of the calmest persons I know is the head of the Met Office here in Jamaica, Evan Thompson. And his voice was shaking when he spoke at a government press conference 2 days ago and said, "We will be having catastrophic floods right across the country, catastrophic winds."
Up to 10,000 small boat migrants are to be housed on military sites in a government drive to end the use of asylum hotels within a year. An initial 900 arrivals will be housed in two army barracks in Inverness and East Sussex from next month. There are plans to build prefab units similar to porter cabins. Isabel McKenzie is a Tory councillor in Inverness. She's told Times Radio that while previous briefings have been useful, this development has come as a surprise.
In the recent couple of years, we were given a very professional, very efficient briefing through the MOD when they came to Inverness to advise us Inverness councillors. What's happened here is just appalling. And I honestly do not think the UK government and the Home Office have done their homework.
And the actress Prunella Scales has died at the age of 93. She was best known for playing hotel manager Sybil Fawlty, the bossy wife of John Cleese's Basil. Her sons Samuel and Joseph say she was watching Fawlty Towers the day before she died. The broadcaster Giles Brandreth was a friend of Prunella Scales. He's told Times Radio she was nothing like Sybil in real life.
Not remotely. That's why she was such a good actress. I mean, she did everything. Mm. Famously. I mean, she could play character. She could get into the character. She won an award, I think, when she played in a play by Alan Bennett, in which she played the late Queen Elizabeth II. And you can't imagine two more different characters than Elizabeth II and Sybil Fawlty. She was just a fine actress.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It is Fee and Rosie with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon here on Times Radio. Thank you for all of your messages. Sarah says, my first memory of seeing Prunella Scales was in the sitcom Marriage Lines with Richard Briers. It was very funny, but you'd have to be in your 70s or older to remember it. Maybe some episodes could be shown as a tribute. I'm sure they will be made a little bit more available now, Sarah. And Helen says, do any alcohol companies give any of their profits to help those who are addicted or harmed by alcohol? And it's a very good question, Helen, and we're going to get you even more fact on this in the next hour of the programme. But yes, Drink Aware, which is one of the main charities trying to educate about alcohol and the dangers of it, is primarily funded by donations from the UK alcohol industry, and it operates independently as a charity. It's got its independent board of trustees. But yes, it is very much funded by the alcohol industry itself and the representative body, the Portman Group. So we will carry on finding out a little bit more about that. That came off the back of our conversation about the gambling industry and whether or not there could ever be a kind of hypothecated tax on industries in order to directly help people who just don't cope very well with either gambling or with drinking. Now, this has been branded the storm of the century by the World Meteorological the weather organisation in the world, with winds reaching 175 miles per hour. And in the last half an hour, Evan Thompson, who's principal director of Jamaica's Meteorological Service, has been giving this briefing.
We did say that the system is a Category 5 hurricane at this time, and when it makes landfall, it is expected to still be a Category 5 hurricane. That means it will cause catastrophic damage, life-threatening damage. There is very little that can stop a Category 5 hurricane. And regardless of the where you are in the parish of Westmoreland or St. Elizabeth, if you are under the impact of those Category 5 hurricane force winds, you will be having significant difficulty even with infrastructure that's in the area.
There's such stark warnings being given, aren't they, ahead of hitting landfall. This is Hurricane Melissa on its way. The Foreign Office is calling for British citizens in Jamaica to register their presence ahead of the anticipated catastrophic impact. Michaela Menezes is a British woman originally from Cheshire, living in the Jamaican capital of Kingston, and she joins us now. Michaela, thank you very much for talking to us this afternoon, because I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that you need to be doing. Can you tell us about conditions there on the ground? Are you safe, and are you going to have to leave your home? Michaela, can you hear us all right? I think we did have Michaela on the line, but quite understandably. Hello. Hello.
Can you hear me? I'm terribly sorry. The bandwidth is atrocious, as you can imagine.
Yeah, do not apologise. Let me just ask a simpler form of that question. How are you? Are you safe?
I've seen better days. We are safe. We are fortified. We are in a hotel that has generators, hurricane glass and water tanks. Yes, none of those things are foolproof, but at least it goes some way to keeping my family safe.
You've lived in Jamaica for 14 years now, I know. Have you ever seen anything like this in terms of the preparations and the warnings being given?
Absolutely not. We had a close call with Hurricane Beryl last year, and a lot of learnings were taken from that. It did not make a direct hit, but we did see damage. We experienced a lot of infrastructure fall apart. I believe there have been a lot of learnings from that, but nothing can prepare an island like this for something of that magnitude.
We have been reporting that some people are very unwilling to leave their homes in what are predicted to be the worst affected areas because they're worried about looting. They are just plain old worried. Is that going to prove to be a very difficult thing for the authorities?
Absolutely, and it's very much cultural in that it is a culture that is very independently minded, very strong-minded and very bullish and hard to convince. There is, of course, a strong feeling that God will take care of us. It's a deeply Christian society, and a suspicion of the authorities. So nobody wants to be rounded up and taken to the shelters that are scattered all across the island.
But the warnings have been so stark, haven't they, Michaela, that actually if you stay in these places, the authorities simply won't be able to help you if it becomes a life and death situation.
Absolutely correct. And I think that nobody had expected it to have this outcome because it's always been a near miss, at least in most people's lifetime.
Are there enough places for people to go if they are being evacuated from their homes?
Yes, and the issue is that the shelters are empty, my understanding.
Right, completely empty?
I believe so. Only a smattering of people are actually showing up and going to them. People would rather stay in their house and resort to their traditional methods, such as boarding up their windows, you know, battening down their roofs, etc.
What do you think will then happen?
Disaster.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think the line's probably gone again. You're freezing just a little bit, but completely understandable in the circumstances. Let's see if we can get Michaela back, because actually she's telling us some pretty important things, which we would certainly appreciate having a little bit more on the ground detail about. I'll tell you what, I'll try one more time, and otherwise we'll go to our next guest and maybe try and get Michaela back on a different line. Michaela, you were just explaining to us what you think might happen if,
yes,
if these people can't be persuaded to leave their homes.
It will be an utter catastrophe. The authorities can only try. You know, already trees are starting to fall down, roads will soon be flooded, and it will be impossible to reach the hard-to-access places.
And how much time do you think that Jamaica has before Melissa really impacts?
I believe it's due to make landfall, I believe, in Westmoreland. And again, the trajectory is changing all the time, but any time within the next couple of hours. But I'm not sure of that because I've been in meetings, so I haven't actually checked. But I believe that is the case.
Sure. Well, look, we really appreciate you talking to us today. You must have so many other people that you need to talk to. We would love to keep in touch with you, Michaela, but our main message is obviously do stay as safe as you can. We were talking there to Michaela Menez, who is a British woman originally originally from Cheshire, but has been living in Kingston for some time now. Let's also talk to Liz Stevens this afternoon, who's an expert in climate risks at the University of Reading. Liz, can you just put into context what might be about to happen with Hurricane Melissa? It's very easy to get a bit carried away with the biggest storm ever, the biggest thing on the planet. What are we talking about here?
Sure. Well, I think what we can say is that this is going to be an unprecedented storm for Jamaica, not just in terms of the category of the wind speed. So it is a Category 5 storm, as you said, but also because it is incredibly slow moving. And we don't mean moving in terms of the wind speeds, but in terms of how that center of the storm is tracking along. Because it is slow moving, that the rainfall is really going to accumulate from this storm. So once it gets over Jamaica, the time period in which it stays there for is going to lead to those higher rainfall accumulations. Alongside that, we'll see the storm surge along the coastal areas, but also flash flooding and potentially landslides as well. It's impossible to predict exactly where those landslides would be, but we're expecting catastrophic impacts from a storm that of this nature.
Can you put some facts and figures on that for us? When you talk about the rainfall, what kind of impact are we talking about there?
So the rainfall totals have said to be in some places reaching up to 40 inches. So that's well more than a metre of water falling. That water, of course, doesn't get spread evenly across the landscape. It gets funneled down the river catchments. That's going to cause, you know, it'd be 1 in 1,000 year flooding in those locations that receive that amount of rainfall. So it's going to be absolutely devastating. That kind of flash flooding as well in itself will cause infrastructure damage. And for people that have maybe taken shelter in their homes thinking that they've been safe before from previous hurricanes, they might not be expecting that they could be impacted from that kind of flooding. We know from other events in parts of the world that when there have been unprecedented floods of this nature, that it's been impossible for people to imagine the scale of the impact. And that is really challenging when it comes to preparing and as we've heard, encouraging people to evacuate safely.
Are you surprised in what you heard there from Michaela, that actually, despite these really severe warnings from the authorities, the shelters are practically empty? People are staying in the predicted to be worst affected areas.
We've seen from previous storms that there are always cases where people, for whatever reason, have decided not to leave their homes. And I think it's important to remember that people are also judging the risk to themselves of leaving. If you leave too late, then you're putting yourself into a dangerous situation traveling during high wind speeds and high rainfall. But also I've seen news reports that people may be fearful about the conditions inside those shelters as well, maybe in terms of violence against women, for example. So there are reasons why people choose not to evacuate. But it's up to the authorities really to allay people's concerns and try to encourage the safest course of action.
Yep. Why is this hurricane so slow moving?
So storms are slow moving, or they're fast moving, driven by the what we call the sort of steering flow. So that's the atmospheric conditions, the wider atmospheric conditions that storm sits in. And in this particular case, there isn't a strong steering flow. So we can see that storm has actually been stationary, almost stationary for quite some time now. In some ways, that has been a good thing because it's provided a lot of warning. The storm has been sitting off the coast of Jamaica. People have been aware of it for some days. But I'm extremely concerned about how slow moving it's going to be. You've heard that people are in hotels with emergency generators. Those generators can only last for so long with a certain amount of fuel. It remains to be seen exactly how long that storm and the impacts of it will linger over Jamaica for.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to us this afternoon. That's Liz Stevens, who's an expert in climate risks at the University of Reading. Obviously, we'll carry on covering this story on Hurricane Melissa. And Luke makes a very good point, actually, that the Turks and Caicos Islands will be next in line. There are 47,000 British citizens living there. Gosh, really, I didn't realise it was quite so high. It will be good to know what the UK is doing to help. We'll have some thoughts on that for you, Luke, as well.
Yeah, I've just been looking at what the US National Hurricane Center have been issuing as a warning, which is why it feels so extraordinary that so many people haven't then gone to those shelters. They say this is an extremely dangerous and life-threatening situation. Take cover now. To protect yourself from the wind, the best thing you can do is put as many walls as possible between you and the outside. The advice goes so far to say, cover yourself with a mattress or wear a helmet if you have one. I mean, it's sort of hard to overstate the gravity of the warnings and therefore then the distress caused by the fact that some people, as we've been hearing, have not been heeding them. We'll have updates for you on this. It's 16 minutes past three now. Coming up here before half past, YouTubers, influencers are being accused of risking lives when they seek out and interact with Indigenous tribes for views. This is For Today and This Week, Rosie and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tough week for Keir Starmer, and we say that quite often at the minute, don't we? That poll for the Times seems to suggest he's in a bit of trouble. The rise of reform, the stagnation of the Tories, the rise of the Greens. We'll see if he can change the narrative leading up to PMQs.
And it's Wednesday, so Giles and Edwina will be here to go through the stories of the day. They are sometimes known by another name, but it escapes me. Jedwina will be here.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
In the UK, 4.3 million children are now living in poverty. And around the world, conflict, hardship and the climate crisis are hitting children hard. Dame Arlene Phillips tells us why she's an ambassador for Save the Children and will be leaving the charity a gift in her will.
I grew up in a very poor area. In our house was a charity box. And when we were given money for birthdays, we always had to put a little bit in the charity box. So I grew up understanding we can always help others. Every child deserves a life that's fulfilling, a life that has care. I know it sounds like a song, but children are our future.
At Save the Children, we believe children shouldn't just survive, they should be able to thrive. By leaving a gift in your will, you too can help children in the UK and over 100 countries worldwide. Find out more by searching Save the Children Gifts in Wales. Save the Children is a registered charity.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious!
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees, conditions apply.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Looking for inspiration for your new kitchen? Let Wix help you find brilliant kitchen ideas. Browse the Wix kitchen gallery or try the matchmaker tool to find a style that suits you. Find the gallery and matchmaker at wix.co.uk. 19 minutes past three. Now, it's claimed British influencers are becoming a growing danger to isolated Indigenous groups around the world whilst those influencers try to boost their views.
Lads, there we see them. There they are. Oh my God, oh my God. Right, you ready? Across this river is an island with hundreds of ancient tribes. One of them eats humans. Is that a bow and arrow?
I think they're pointing bow and arrows.
He's not looking friendly. I'm about to make contact and live with one of the last remaining cannibal tribes on Earth.
Oh my God, I hope they don't kill us.
How do we say I come in peace? Seriously, this is terrifying.
I mean, there's so much glee in his voice there, isn't there? That's the YouTuber Dara Tarr's three-day survival on Cannibal Island video. The charity Survival International says around 90 ancient tribes are likely to face extinction in the next 10 years as social media influencers, missionaries, tourists threaten to expose the uncontacted tribes to new diseases. In a moment, we're going to speak to Benedict Allen, a modern-day explorer whose expeditions rely on knowledge of Indigenous people that he meets in the areas he travels to. But first, let's hear from Sophie Grieg, Asia Campaigns Director at Survival International. Sophie, good afternoon.
Hello.
I think traditionally we've heard about the risks to these communities from things like logging, mining, missionaries, now influencers. What's happening?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And still, logging and mining are, you know, they're the greatest risks, and the extractive industry is the biggest risk to uncontacted peoples. But we are seeing a growing threat from these wannabe influencers, people who are trying to get attention to themselves and their, you know, their social media pages by taking incredible risks and trying to go and make contact with uncontacted peoples. And uncontacted peoples are, as you say, incredibly vulnerable to diseases. They don't have the immunities that you or I would have to flu or to measles. And so it's incredibly dangerous, this thing that these influencers are trying to do.
Some of these groups of people are protected by law, aren't they? You say you're not allowed within a certain distance of them. Are you finding that laws are being ignored in the pursuit of views and clicks?
Absolutely. And we saw that really exposed shockingly in March this year when Polyakov, an American YouTuber influencer, tried to go and make contact with the people in North Sentinel Island. And the people in North Sentinel are uncontacted. They are the most isolated peoples on the planet because they live on their own island with no one else on the island with them. And they made this really clear, active choice to stay uncontacted and very clearly send signs to anybody who tries to go near that they'll raise their bows and arrows at them and warn them off. And in fact, only a few years ago, an American missionary tried to go there and they warned him to stay back. He ignored those warnings and they killed him. And so Polyakov earlier this year, this young influencer, decided he was going to go in order to try and get, you know, fame and clicks. And he went and he took a canoe just outside the island, which is protected. No one's supposed to go within 5 kilometres of the shore. He went, he blew a whistle, he tried to attract their attention. Fortunately, you know, probably they were hunting on the other side of the island or something. And so they didn't, he didn't see any of them, but he came out onto the island. He left a Diet Coke and a coconut for them, stood around for about 5 minutes filming, and then went back and was arrested when he got back. But, you know, if he had met them, if he had got into contact with them, he could have given them, passed on something that could have wiped the entire people out. And it was an incredibly dangerous and stupid thing to do, you know, for the pursuit of his own fame and for, you know, the attention that he thought he was going to get from this.
Sophie, hold right there for a moment or two. We're also joined by Benedict Allen, the modern day explorer. And, you know, Benedict, you talk at length about how you have used the knowledge and expertise of indigenous groups as a method for exploring for a long time. What have you in the past been considering before you make contact with a group who may not have had contact with any other human up until that point?
Well, I should say that nearly always these are people who are very much contacted, and there's so much knowledge from Indigenous people that we can all share from. And so I try and go with a sense of humility and learn very quietly with communities that have regular contact with the outside world. There have only been lots of people in my entire career who you could say were uncontacted. I don't think I now would ever approach such communities, but I was invited both times into these communities, and that's a very, very big difference. So I had been in the area maybe for 6 months on both occasions, knew the national language, it was in West Papua and also in Papua New Guinea, and then was invited into a community that was very much under a very current danger. Loggers, gold miners were moving in, and missionaries in both cases. So the time was running out for both communities, and they were very aware of it, and they knew I was in the area, and I was asked to go in and record a way of life that they knew was going to end. So very, very different circumstance, but I try and go in very, very quietly, and certainly not for clicks or anything like that. It's simply as someone with a background in environmental science and with 40 years experience of living in rainforest and so on.
You mentioned that you wouldn't do that now. Why so?
I think I'd just be more... I'm so much aware now of how much there is to learn without having to do anything as silly. I think Sophie speaking earlier, saying this is all about bringing attention to themselves. My job as a so-called explorer, you could say I'm an environmental scientist or simply a writer, is to go in there and bear witness to that environment and understand that environment. I'm not going in there to get attention to myself. I'm simply there as an observer. So I don't think it's necessary to to disrupt a way of life when I haven't been invited in. I think that's the key, probably. Invitation is a very different thing. So much to learn without doing these tricks, doing this performance. Mm. It's almost like a sort of modern-day colonialism, this sort of idea that you can just go in there for our gratification. This isn't really meant to be about gratification.
You've in the past documented some... I think I'm sorry that we're battling with the line a little bit. Let's persevere just for a moment or two longer. You've documented some quite dramatic initiation ceremonies that you've taken part in that have been, you know, extremely lengthy at times online to sort of make contact with these Indigenous peoples. Are you nervous that those influencers might be looking at some of your content and the interviews you do now and being inspired by it?
I hope inspired in the right way. There was a series on the BBC called Tribe, which did worry me, and some anthropologists I knew called it anthro-trash, you know, sort of glamorising Indigenous people. For me, it's a vague quote that might go on for months and months and months. I nearly always self-film. I don't go in with a big camera crew, and so it's a very quiet process of recording everyday life. So I try and emphasise the most days are just ordinary days in the rainforest, not particularly exciting. It's not all about dramatic rituals. It's not all about danger. Not about. I mean, this influence, I was talking about cannibalism. I'm almost certain that's a sort of myth. I don't know which group he was talking about, but people love to fantasise about the exotic. And my job is to make any communities that I do record come over as the people they are, and they are simply people, just like us, with daily struggles. That's the emphasis of any message I bring.
Benedict, thank you for your time. Benedict Allen, the modern day explorer there, and thank you for bearing with the line. Sophie is still with us. Sophie, what will stop this? Because if the law has not deterred some influencers, might a campaign that you have launched do something similar? Because it seems as though that the pursuit of the drama actually supersedes the desire to be responsible.
Yeah, and I think we have to really educate people about the incredible risks that there are to uncontacted peoples of any sort of contact. And obviously, you know, it seems particularly egregious when it's people going for their own entertainment or the entertainment of others. But any contact, however well-meaning or, you know, however well-intentioned they might think they're being, is incredibly dangerous, and we have to explain and educate people about that. And the laws have to be enforced, and so there are the laws, but then, you know, for example, in North Sentinel, it's essential that not only do they have this law in place, but they actually implement it, which means that the Coast Guard has to properly patrol the waters and ensure that people going in and trying to steal the resources from the Sentinelese or go and you know, film themselves landing there or whatever, it's properly enforced. So enforcement, the laws, which are, you know, there are laws under international human rights law that ban contact or going in uninvited, you know, without the consent of uncontacted people. Of course, they cannot give consent, so therefore no activity should be taking place on their land whatsoever. And so it's really important that both those laws are in place and that they're properly enforced.
Sophie, thank you. Sophie Grigg, Asia Campaigns Director at Survival International, on that latest report they issued this week.
Jan in Dalston says, I think these social media invaders should be treated like poachers and shot on sight. It's the ultimate sociopathic behaviour. Well, the truth of it is, Jan, one day they might well be, because if you are part of an Indigenous people who see coming towards you some idiot with a camera flashing in your face, offering, what was it, a can of Diet Coke and something else
in that case,
to trap you, you might well think, well, that's a predatory animal, off we go.
And there was a missionary who landed on the same island who was killed by that group of people with, you know, very clear warnings in advance that, you know, if you encroach on that territory, that could be a consequence.
Yep, Jan, it may well happen. It may well already have happened. Coming up, Patterson Joseph tells us about the children who changed the world. You're listening to Times Radio. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Pete. Good afternoon. Rachel Reeves is expected to have to find an extra £7 billion in her budget next month. It appears the Office for Budget Responsibility has downgraded its productivity forecast by 0.1%, resulting in the shortfall. The OBR will send the Chancellor the final draft of its economic forecast on Friday. Hurricane Melissa is continuing to strengthen as it approaches Jamaica and now has sustained wind speeds of 185 miles an hour at its centre. According to the National Hurricane Centre, that makes it the second strongest storm in terms of wind speed in Atlantic history, trailing only Hurricane Allen, which hit 190 miles an hour in 1980. A third of people in Jamaica are already without power. And Prunella Scales, who played Sybil in Fawlty Towers, has died at the age of 93. John Cleese, who played her on-screen husband Basil, says she was a really wonderful comic actress and in scene after scene was absolutely perfect. She'd had dementia for more than 10 years, but her family say she was watching Fawlty Towers the day before she died.
All right, what's going on?
I was in the bathroom!
Here she was, dear. So I just popped in to have a look at these hinges, you know, the ones we've been...
Do you really imagine, even in your wildest dreams, that a girl like this could possibly be interested in an ageing, brilliantine stick insect like you?
Prunella Scales, who's died at the age of 93. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for a Times News briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
My dad was a fantastic builder. Plumbing, electrics, carpentry, there was nothing he couldn't do. But he's 83 now, and he can't do any of that stuff anymore. That's hard when you've always been so capable. Unfortunately, Mum died a couple of years ago now, so he does feel quite isolated. Huh. At least he did until Kerry arrived. She's been amazing. She's Dad's care professional from Home Instead. They provide the best quality care in your own home. Dad'll never want to leave that cottage. Well, he restored it practically from scratch, all on his own. We all pop over to see him whenever we can, but we've all got busy lives. So it's real peace of mind that Kerry can be there when we're not. She helps him with all the things he can't do for himself anymore. But we've told her the only thing she's allowed to do relating to building is make Dad's favourite builder's brew.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SEG tariff.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Weekday afternoons on Times Radio with Wix. Are you dreaming of a new kitchen? Let Wix guide you through the wide range of stunning styles, appliances and worktops. Kitchens start from under £3,000. Get started by booking your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
26 minutes to four. You might know our next guest from Peep Show, where he played the creepy, complex and egotistical Alan Johnson, or maybe from Vigil or Green Wing, or from his many appearances on stage. Patterson Joseph is a versatile actor with a passion for prose, and he's just published a book for kids. Don't worry, he did write it himself. It's called 10 Children Who Changed the World, and in it he tells us about the lives of 10 kids whose remarkable experiences might not so far have got the attention they deserved. Patterson's passion is to educate, especially about the history that hasn't been taught in schools, because of a concentration on the heroes and characters from a pretty narrow part of our history, largely white and powerful men with the odd female monarch or wife thrown in. That is where we started our chat.
I think I've just had an itch to write stories that are sort of origin stories. I was talking to a couple of thousand kids last week at various schools, and I always start with the truth, which is that I loved Marvel comics and DC comics when I was growing up. My dad introduced them to me when I was about five or six, and they always have origin stories. You know, Peter Parker, nerdy scientist gets bitten by a radioactive spider. They're not likely stories, but you sort of believe, oh my gosh, now he can shoot webs out of his... So who are these kids? These kids are... They grow up to be extraordinary men and women, but how do they begin? And I'm curious about people's origins. I want to know what people thought they were going to do when they were 10 years old. I certainly had no clue that I was going to be an actor and do all the rest of the stuff that I was going to do. I was, you know, the thick kid in the school, officially. And here are these kids who, some of them are scientists, some are actors, some writers, poets, some girls who dressed up as boys and joined the Royal Navy. They've just got amazing stories. But how were they at 10 years old? Did they have any inkling that they were going to do this? Going into schools and sort of sharing that, no matter what your conditions are, no matter what's happening at home or at school, this isn't it. That your life has a future and actually you should be optimistic because look at these kids.
So which out of the 10 children would really have sent your imagination and ambition into overdrive if you'd been able to know about their history when you were 10 years old?
Oh, that's a really tricky question. I don't know. I mean, I could pick anyone. The obvious one is Ira Aldridge. So Ira Aldridge was an African-American boy, born about 1790. By the time he's 17, he has desperately wanted to join the theatre. They wouldn't let him in New York do the stuff he wants to do, Shakespeare, so he comes to England. And he gets his first acting job at the Royal Coburg Theatre, now RM Old Vic. And he becomes a Shakespearean actor and becomes the first actual black person to play Othello. It's so ridiculous, like a couple of hundred years after the play, everybody used to put brow makeup on, blackface as they call it. And here's Ira. And there were riots in London after the performance. How dare a black man actually touch a white woman? Have you read the play, people? And he becomes this star in Europe, ends up, you know, in running the Belgrade Theatre in Coventry, which is still going, travels Europe, many awards, and dies in Poland at the age of about 61. And his daughters then go on to become opera singers and composers. And that story, if I'd known that story when I was a kid, acting wouldn't have been on the moon. The idea of being an artist, despite your condition, wouldn't have been on the moon. So that would have been an encouraging story. But there's so many of them.
So tell us a little bit more about some of the others, because obviously I was quite drawn as well to the girls who you include. And can you tell us about the girl who dressed up as a boy and then went to see?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know much about her. Which is, look, the whole thing about this history is it's not been around. It's not been in movies, and there are extraordinary stories, plays, novels. I didn't know anything about these kids until, you know, much later in my life. But William Brown, and that's the only name we have, was a Grenadian kid, and she clearly didn't want to just be a Grenadian kid in the middle of slavery. She wanted another kind of life. She ran away from home, clearly, and joined the Royal Navy. We only find her when she's about 24, I think. Early 20s, anyway. They discover that she's a girl, pretending to be a boy. What happened to her after that, we don't know. But she's had this whole life of being on board ship, not being discovered. I just think it would make an extraordinary film, and it would make an extraordinary bigger novel even. And it sort of troubled me, actually, Fee, that these stories hadn't been out there, because if I can see them, and I'm just a schlubby actor with no degrees or anything to my name.
Stop it.
No, it's true. It's absolutely true. I'm very bad academically. But they're just great stories.
Why don't we
know these stories? I think about someone like John Edmonston, who I only really found out about very recently. Now, John was born in Guyana, in South America. And he's trained to be a guide in the jungle and is taught taxidermy. And because he's taught taxidermy and he's so good at it, his master, I suppose, a guy called Charles Waterton, takes him to Edinburgh, where he starts to train, you know, young students, and he ends up training Charles Darwin. And Darwin writes about, I spent how many guineas to see this man, because he was so brilliant and we had many, many hours together and he taught me about taxidermy. And I think that's quite a vital skill for someone like Darwin to know. And why don't we know about this guy? It's so interesting. And of course, infuriating too, in some ways, that we don't know these stories, because your confidence grows when you know people like you have been around.
Exactly. And you can't be it if you can't see it.
That's the truth.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more from a writer's perspective, though, about this thing called critical fabulation, because I'd never heard of that term.
No, I had only heard about it recently myself, because I've been doing it. And you must say critical fabulation, because it's an American phrase by a lovely lady called Saidiya Hartman, who's a writer and a historian. So she says, look, the archives for women in particular are threadbare, and for black women, even thinner. What you need to do is look at possibly where they were born, if you can figure that out, where they ended up, and where they died, and find the links between those three points by piecing together other people who are of the same demographic. What was happening in Georgia, for example, in 1901? There was maybe a famine, or there was something that happened that, you know, made that there was a bit of a depression and people moved out and moved north. You discover someone, she would say, in a ghetto in Harlem with four kids by four different men, and you go, oh, she's just a prostitute. But actually, when you find out what her story is, this girl had to leave where she was born, had to travel like a lot of these girls did. And then what were they going to do when they arrived in New York? There could have been some sort of welfare, but there was very little help. So they ended up in the easiest job that they could get. And there you might find that they're in prostitution, or they just happen to have wayward men around them. So you get a sense of empathy rather than a statistic. And that's what's really important to me, the story.
And also it's simply enabling you to tell a story about somebody's life to make up for the fact that there are threadbare accounts of so many people. Because otherwise you'd go, I can't tell this story because I don't have enough facts.
Yeah, and also facts don't stick. I don't know about anybody else, but I don't remember any facts. I said to the kids, you know, history is boring. 1066, William the Conqueror. And I'm already asleep by the time you finish the sentence. Yes. But what you want to know is that William the Conqueror had a jippy tummy because he had some herring or something that morning.
It's so true.
And his wife gave him some ginger root and then he was fine. Do you know, that's the story you want, because that's what will stick. Human beings don't remember numbers, and actually they can change and move and shift, but the story is with us forever. You think about the stories you read as a kid or you were told as a kid. The pictures even of them are in your head still.
Yeah. Let's talk about stories, and let's talk about what we see on our TV screens. And I do want to know what you think about the Reform MP Sarah Poachin's comments about there being, for her taste, and this has been described by the leader of her party as a pretty ugly position to have, there are simply too many black and Asian families in advertisements in this country, and it is not reflecting who we are. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't know who the we she's talking about, because I live in Brent. I grew up in Brent. It's the most multicultural borough in the country.
It is the most diverse borough in the country.
Actually, it would be very odd. If you went to any hospital there or any doctor's surgery there and there were a bunch of, is there any white people behind the desk or any white families in there seeking help, you would be looking around and going, where is everybody? Because actually, everyone is from everywhere. There are Somalians, Ethiopians, Polish people, people from Bulgaria, Indians. Everybody's there. Caribbeans, Irish, that I grew up with. It's a world that she clearly, I mean, I don't know anything about this. I don't sort of follow that kind of news because I'm not a politician, so I don't need to know what they're talking about. But you can live in a bubble. You know, you can live in a bubble and think, this is my world. And this is the world. My little corner is the world. And that's probably the saddest thing I think about human beings. You've got this vast planet with all these wonderful ethnicities and cultures, and your narrow view is this is the only culture that should be here. We shouldn't be seeing much of anything else. I think it's very strange to think like that.
Do you also think, though, that we simply haven't told the story of immigration very well in this country over the last 100 years, I mean 75 years in particular, where what you're doing now with this book, which is fantastic, is you are not simply saying these are children of colour. You're saying these are children who did remarkable things, and the one thing that they might have in common, as well as doing remarkable things, is that they're not white children who we know an awful lot about. If we can't tell the stories that join us all up, that fire our imaginations up, we are doing our society a disservice, isn't it? We are not finding
a common experience.
Yeah, no. When I first started, that's really good, Fee, because when I first started doing these, so 1999, I basically wanted to be in a costume driver. I've been working with Ray Fiennes for years and Simon Russell Beale, and I've been doing all the Shakespeare-y stuff. And I thought, you know what? I'd like to be in these plays. And I was always told, usually by in those days, a smoking director, Patterson, darling, we'd love to have you in this production, but of course, there were no black people in England before 1948. And I just imbibed that. I remember it happening in the ROC. I just imbibed that. Yeah, of course, yeah, that's true. So in 19, I was like, you know what? There must be one person before 1948. And I find this array of characters. And the first thing I used to say, Fee, to people was, look, from Septimius Severus, the African emperor who came here in sort of AD 119 or whatever, and with his Syrian wife, the Libyan emperor, all the way to John Blank, who was the trumpeter for Henry VII and Henry VIII, Ignatius Sancho, of course, the man I write about, who kind of worked for the royal family through the Montagues, the Elizabethan world, you know, all of these stories are our stories. We talk about black history as if it's some sort of separate entity. It's intertwined. If it was only black history, it would just have taken place in Africa. But unfortunately, the Portuguese, and then the French, and then the British, and then the Dutch, and then everybody else took African people and brought them out of Africa. So our stories have been intertwined ever since navigation happened, ever since people travelled. Don't you want to know that richness? I've got Irish friends, blue-eyed, blonde-haired Irish friends. Person, I just found 7% sub-Saharan African in my DNA. It's like, yes, probably those troops who came over with Septimius Severus from Eastern Europe, probably North African, sub-Saharan African troops. Isn't that fascinating? Rather than something to be sort of hiding from or to be afraid of. Come on. This is like turning up the colour contrast on our history. You know, we see it fully now.
So I hear you when you say that you don't follow politics, but you're out and about in the world, and I wonder whether you really feel that turning up of division, actually, about colour at the moment.
Well, I live a privileged life, of course. I'm known, Fee. So it's very different when you go, like when I go to France, for example, I was in France for my son's graduation and people don't know you, you really can feel a sort of sense of hostility from people until they talk to you or they get to know you or you know, you smile at them. There is a sort of natural, it feels, but it's learned behaviour, fear, hostility towards the stranger, the other. And that's just a human thing through ignorance, through fear, all of the rest of it. So I do see it. But I have to say that I don't suffer it as much as the next person simply because of my face. So this is, in my past, I've absolutely known it. And you've seen it, I've seen it in education. I mean, I was labelled educationally subnormal before I'd opened my mouth at 4.5 years old, as well as the Irish kids I was hanging out with, you know, in my school in Wilson Green. None of us had done anything and we'd been labelled that way. So you sort of got used to being othered. So I actually, it could come at me, Fee, and I probably wouldn't really notice it as much. If somebody comes at me physically, sure, but the other sort of little incremental aggressions, I try and just, you know, not to notice them because they're so exhausting if you do.
Sure, I can believe that. You were in Vigil, weren't you?
I sunk a submarine for the BBC.
Yes. Vigil was, I thought, absolutely superb. Oh. What an amazing thing to be part of. But the claustrophobia of the filming must have been quite something. But were you down in the submarine all the time?
Well, I mean, thank goodness they didn't actually do that. I didn't suffer from claustrophobia, but the set was very close. I mean, everybody was saying, oh, it doesn't really look like a submarine, it looks bigger. Well, nuclear submarines, which they've all been pretty much since after the Second World War, are bigger than the ones we see on movies. You know, you could think you could bang your head just walking down the corridor because they've got such massive warheads there that they has to be quite big. But it was lockdown, remember? Just after the big lockdown, we went back in. So there was a lot of protocol. There was a lot of channeling people into certain areas and it did feel claustrophobic. But I must say, when I watched it back, because I didn't know any of the stuff, we didn't film any of the stuff, on land, I found myself letting my breath out when we suddenly saw the Scottish landscape. Yeah. Which is such a strange thing. I know what the story is, but I found myself really shallow breathing through all the stuff that Suran was doing on the boat. And then you'd get out and I've never, had that visceral experience watching something, especially something I've already seen.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It was a very tight feeling when you were watching it. What is your next project?
Film project, zero, unemployed at the moment, available for work, everybody. At theatre, I am loving doing a sort of version of my book tour, but it's sort of a play as well. So I've got Ben Park, the amazing Ben Park, who plays music and underscores me, doing a talk on my life, 60s, 70s London, and Ignatius Sancho, one of the first black people to vote, life, 1770s, 1780s, and I splice our lives together using the novel. The Secret Diaries of Charles Ignatius Sancho. We have a bit of music and it's so improvised. And then I foolishly dress up as Sancho for the second half and answer any questions that people have.
And does anybody who was either one of your contemporaries at school or any of your teachers who were at your school who had the temerity to call you thick... Clearly you're not. Do you keep in touch with them? Do they see what you've done with your life?
Oh, dear Mrs. Bird. Claudette Birdie Bird, she was at my primary school, St. Mary Magdalene's, shout out, at Wilsdon Green. And she kept in touch with me and my family because some of my nieces went to her school. She passed away a few years ago, unfortunately. But she was wonderful. She was from Goa. She was the only teacher who wasn't white that I had, and also the kindest teacher. She thought I was a cheeky little beggar, and she didn't understand why I couldn't deal with the academic side. But I'd given up at 4.5, as I said, as they gave up on me. But she thought I had something. And she'd give me things like little quotes from Shakespeare, and I'd go, I don't know why she's given me this, but she clearly thinks I can do something with... I don't know what this is. But it's only years later, when I actually became an actor at 18, that I looked back and I went, she saw something in me. She saw something of my love of words. I mean, I could always read, and I was always good at reading out loud because my older sisters would do school with me from the age of 3. I hated it then, but I was glad of it afterwards. And I think she caught that. She caught my love of words and my interest in words and my ability to sort of perform, if you like, reading. I think she planted a seed of encouragement. Unfortunately, she did see a lot of I would say, my success. But I would have loved to have seen what she would have made of my writing, because she never really got to see that bit of it. You got me going now.
It's always our aim to make people cry. No, it's really not. It is absolutely lovely to meet you. And it's always worth saying a little bit about what happens behind the scenes here at Times Towers. And when you came in, every single person you've met has wanted to say, oh my God, it's you, it's so great to meet you. Everybody seems to be incredibly pleased that you're here.
Alan Johnson, that horrible, horrible man. I don't know why, from Peep Show, he's just such a horrible person.
Yeah.
But there you go, people like a villain, I guess.
Yes, but you've come out of it well. Do you want to hold the book up once more for radio?
What book?
There it is, kids.
And there it is, especially for radio that now has pictures. It is 10 children who changed the world, and it was lovely to spend 20 minutes with Paterson. Just to return to yesterday's topic that has definitely bled into today, and we'll carry on talking about it too. One of our text messages says that Sarah Poaching was referring to percentage representation in ads, which is valid. And I don't think anybody's disputing that at all. But isn't it also just a fact that no company wants to be the one that only sees a white Briton, and therefore there is high representation of other communities? And if you look at the plain facts and figures, if you know that 9% of the population is Asian, you've only got 4 people playing different parts of a family in an ad. What are you meant to do if you want to show that you embrace a diverse Briton? You know, just have, you know, a kind of an Asian hand in there. How would you be able to display that? And that's the point, isn't it? It's how you react when this lands with you. I think that's what we're all trying to discuss at the moment. Let us just fill you in, because Helen wanted a little bit more detail on whether or not the alcohol industry was being helpful in terms of people who might have a problem using their products. So, Diageo runs a programme that aims to raise the collective drink IQ by increasing public awareness of the effects of alcohol and supporting responsible drinking. And DrinkAware, funded by the industry, received more than £5,800,000 in donations in 2024. And AB InBev funds projects in Brazil, Mexico, Belgium and South Africa on reducing alcohol abuse. I don't know whether or not I've got that acronym at the beginning right, because I don't recognise it at all, but maybe you do. So I hope that that has been a little bit informative as to the responsibility behind that industry.
And perhaps then what responsibility should fall on gambling companies, as we were talking a bit earlier. Rachel Reeves is eyeing up. As you well know, and I'm sure John Pina will tell us more on Drive a little bit later about where she can claw back some of that cash. And she's been meeting with representatives from the gambling industry because it could be that that is where she says, I would like to scrape back some more to put into public finances that comes from those sort of, as they're described, as sin taxes.
Sin taxes.
Woof. Like drink taxes, gambling taxes, etc.
It is 3 minutes to four.
Weekday mornings on Times Radio with Bupa Small Business Health Insurance. When it comes to must-listen mid-morning radio, we've got you covered. There's world-class journalism to broaden your mind, in-depth discussion that gets right to the heart of the issues, and entertaining conversation guaranteed to tickle your funny bone. Weekday mornings on Times Radio with Bupa Small Business Health Insurance, your trusted business partner for health and wellbeing support. Find out more at bupa.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
The UK's first human heart transplant has been completed, supported by the British Heart Foundation.
We were a noisy generation, but it might be something quiet we do that becomes our greatest legacy. Leave a gift in your will to the British Heart Foundation and fund groundbreaking research that could help save millions of lives. Search BHF Wills.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious.
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees. Conditions apply.
At Buy Association, we stay one step ahead of the property market, and our team of experts have identified the halo at Oval Village as London's next landmark home. This stunning development with a coveted Zone 1 postcode offers luxury living overlooking the iconic Oval Cricket Ground. To find out more about 1, 2 and 3 bedroom apartments at the Halo Oval Village, request your free brochure today. Text BA Radio Oval to 66777. By Association, ahead of the market since 2005.
This is Times Radio.
So thank you very much indeed for your company this afternoon and for all of your messages. To inject a tiny bit of humour, here comes Catherine, who says if she can't cope with the ads with people in, what on earth does she think of the British Gas ad with the blue monsters calling the Thing family?
Yeah, there we go. Good point.
Jung Chang is our guest on the programme tomorrow. You will recognise the name, I hope, as the author of her extraordinary memoir, Wild Swans, which detailed three generations in her family and their life in communist China. She has a new memoir out, so there's plenty to talk about there. And boy, will she be able to tell us some things about what the Chinese state expects of its citizens and what it might know about ours as well. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. My thanks to Rosie Wright, who is sitting in for Jane Garvey for the rest of the week. And up next, it'll be John Pienaar with Drive. Have a great evening when you get to it.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Rosie. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. The eye of the world's strongest storm of the year is about to make landfall in Jamaica. And hundreds of female recruits have come forward to allege sexual abuse during medical examinations to join the British Army over 5 decades. Now, coming up, as Hurricane Melissa makes landfall in Jamaica, we'll get the latest on the ground. We'll bring you the news on the Afghan data leak from earlier this year and the impact it has had on those in Afghanistan. And we're going to look at government plans to house asylum seekers on military bases and the criminal gangs driving fly-tipping across the country.
This is Times Radio.
And here's the news with Andy Hayes.
John, good afternoon. The eye of the strongest storm of the year, Hurricane Melissa, is expected to hit Jamaica within the next hour or so. Almost 6,000 shelters are in place and people are being urged to take safety measures. Up to 8,000 British tourists are there, while the island is home to around 50,000 dual nationals. Jamaica's Minister of Local Government, Desmond Mackenzie, has this stark warning.
Jamaica, this is not the time to be brave. I've been saying for 1 week, don't bet against Melissa. It is a bet we can't win.
Rachel Reeves is expected to have to find an extra £7 billion in her budget next month. It appears the Office for Budget Responsibility has downgraded its productivity forecast by 0.1%, resulting in the shortfall. The OBR will send the final draft of its economic forecast to the Chancellor on Friday. Paul Johnson, the former director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, has told Times Radio that Reeves has a massive financial hole to fill.
If she really does need to raise significant taxes, and it looks like she might be in the 30 or 40 billion pound territory, and that's a pretty big increase in tax. That's 1.5% of national income. I think if she needs to do that, then it's really very hard to see how she does that without raising one of the big ones, income tax, national insurance, or VAT.
Labour has fallen to its lowest rating in a YouGov poll. The survey for The Times finds only 17% of voters would back the party were a general election held today. The Tories are also on 17, with the Greens just 1 point behind. Reform has a 10-point lead on 27%. A 22-year-old Afghan man's been arrested after a triple stabbing left one man dead and a 14-year-old boy injured. Emergency services were called to Uxbridge, West London, at about 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon. A 49-year-old man was treated by ambulance crews but died at the scene, while a 45-year-old man suffered life-changing injuries. The teenager's injuries are not life-threatening. Hundreds of female recruits have come forward to allege sexual abuse during medical examinations to join the British Army over 5 decades. Sources have disclosed the information to The Times. Wiltshire Police said the alleged abuse took place at several army locations in the UK between the 1970s and 2016. A woman who's accused of stalking the family of Madeleine McCann claims she never intended to cause them distress. Prosecutors allege Julia Wandelt, who's Polish, plagued Madeleine's parents with calls, emails, and even turned up at their home, claiming to have memories that proved she was their daughter. She denies the charges. Madeleine disappeared in Portugal in 2007. And Amazon is cutting about 4,000 jobs globally. The online retailer is expected to slim down its human resources, operations and devices departments in favour of AI. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Melissa, an oddly sweet-sounding name for one of the most powerful Atlantic storms ever seen, is hitting Jamaica. And the Caribbean island is braced for what's coming in these coming hours. Winds of 175 miles an hour and more will mean deaths. At least 3 people have died already. And massive destruction, despite official warnings, calls to evacuate the most vulnerable areas. On the programme today, we'll have the latest on the hurricane, on the damage that Melissa is wreaking, and on the planning to cope with the storm and its aftermath. Firstly, do you remember the massive data leak which exposed the identity of up to 100,000 Afghans who'd worked with Britain and British forces? Do you also remember an official review suggesting it was highly unlikely anyone would be killed as a result? Well, 49 Afghans have been killed, according to reports on the ground. And we'll be joined in a moment by the Times Defence editor, Larissa Brown. Tell me, what are you thinking now? Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. We're going to start with that story, the Ministry of Defence data leak that revealed the identities of Afghans working for the British state. It's resulted in the killing of at least 49 people, it's now reported. And that's according to a study submitted to the inquiry into the scandal. I can welcome now to the programme, live on the line, Larissa Brown, the Times Defence editor. Hello to you, Larissa.
Hello.
Hi, Larissa. This is quite a story. 49 Afghans said to have been killed. This is the claim in evidence from campaign and support groups in Afghanistan. Tell us more.
Yes, this is based on a survey to 351 Afghans. Some of those are in the UK and have got family members in Afghanistan, and others are still stuck in Afghanistan. And those people who were affected by the late leak, whose names were on this database, and don't forget this database had tens of thousands of Afghan names on it, have basically documented the suffering that they have gone through after the news of the leak was published and it became clear that their names were on it. And some of those have said that their family members or people that they know have been killed after the details of the leak were published. Now, the MOD has said that they don't think the Taliban has currently got that list. They don't, you know, they really haven't got a clue, and they haven't had a clue for months. So it's an interesting report, and it's one that, you know, I wish that we could delve more into and interview those Afghans, and that's what I'll be trying to do.
Yes. I mean, it is a curious situation, this, isn't it? You first of all wonder, how could the government know whether this list, these names, or at least some of the list or some of the names, have got into the hands of the Taliban?
Well, that's exactly the point that actually we, as media defendants, the Times and other organisations, were making for the best part of 2 years, because the MOD doesn't actually know whether the Taliban have got the list or not. They've never been sure. They've just thought that they probably haven't. And there was a risk always throughout this case where we weren't able to report any of the details, that at some point the Taliban could suddenly get their hands on the list and then go around killing the Afghans on it. And the MOD just didn't know whether they had it or not. And that was what we were worried about.
Yeah, it's difficult to imagine. Of course, you know, one can't know, I suppose. But it's difficult to imagine that these accounts of people being killed, who were clearly a part of the list, who were working with the British state, that these accounts are false, that they are all false. That's really quite a big ask. Larissa, what do we know of the conduct of the Taliban since they took power? Because they're